Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1, 3, or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.
Hello and welcome to the Don't Break the Oath Halloween Special, with returning guest and author, Vala Ventura. Now, some of you may remember Vala from a previous episode that she came on to talk about fairies with me, and she's returning today to talk about some other tales, from werewolves to vampires, which, you know, we thought would be suitable for Halloween. I must just point out that we are recording, we're a couple of episodes ahead, so obviously our new recording stuff, new mics and that, won't be featured on the next couple of shows because it's pre-recorded, so just bear that in mind. Big thank you to everybody that subscribed and told a friend. You know, our numbers are increasing every week, so you guys must be spreading the word, so we can't thank you enough for that. And Mr. McDermott, thank you very much for your donation, very generous. And that will go towards our recording studio, which we are building at the moment, which, you know, will take a bit of time, but we'll get there. So everything like that, you know, buy a t-shirt, that kind of stuff, anything like that helps us massively. We can't thank you enough. So thank you again, Mr. Dermot. Right, so we get on with the show. I give you Vala Ventura. Happy Halloween!
There's real, and then there's, are you actually going to run into one? And so I think, you know, there's a difference between what you're going to see when you're out walking and you're looking, and what might come to you in the middle of the night, or what was once real and perhaps is now more elusive. You know, for me, the creature I struggle with belief in the most is Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
And that is actually something that a lot of people who don't even believe in ghosts seek after. And it's not that I completely I believe that there's Bigfoot-like creatures. I just don't believe most of the accounts that people put out about them. I just don't think Bigfoot would even bother most of the time.
We've had people on the show, haven't we, and said, you know, that some are physical, and sometimes it says no, they're interdimensional. You know, they come in and out of frequency, and you know. So, I think we're getting kind of a mixed bag, maybe more than one race or species, aren't we?
Really? Yeah.
Same with the dog.
Sure.
Man. Same with the dog,
sure.
Man, I think, as well. So,
it's a bit, the Bigfoot. I mean, there's a lot of sort of evidence that points towards Bigfoot. So that's really where I sort of...
I know.
Yeah.
I know, but I don't know what it is. It's just, I just don't believe... I know, me, of all people, I'm like a Bigfoot skeptic. Of all the things, right? Yeah. Like, oh, that lady believes in mermaids and she doesn't think Bigfoot's real. What's wrong with her?
I'm with you on the old, feeding them apples and all that, playing them flute music. I think that's pretty bullshit.
Yeah, definitely. And I wouldn't go near these creatures, really.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that.
No.
So, should we start with, I don't know, how good your memory? Because it was a while ago since you wrote the werewolf book, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's fairly good. I mean, Bigfoot's actually a good segue into werewolves, because werewolves I find to be much more credible
Yeah. Do you think this, you know, what people call the Dogman these days, do you think, you know, the werewolf mythos comes from?
Yes, I kind of, like, those creatures, I sort of lump those all into the idea of werewolves, modern day werewolves. And, you know, one of the, just to dive right into it, one of the reasons that werewolves are the most convinced, now I've always been fascinated with werewolves. I grew up on all the classic horror movies. I love all the, you know, I love vampires. I love werewolves. I love Frankenstein, you know, all these kind of like classic horror icons. But, werewolves, when I was researching the book, I came upon this massive volume of work by a man who was, he was an English reverend. I think in the mid 1800s, his name was Sabine Baring Gould. And he wrote, I'm probably saying his name wrong, but he wrote Onward Christian Soldiers. So that's like his sort of bombastic legacy, you know, just kind of what he's most well known for. And he was a pretty prolific writer. But one of his, I guess, a lesser known side project of his, was researching werewolves. And he traveled around, especially in parts of Scandinavia and Northern Europe, and he recorded a lot of what people were saying about werewolves, what their practices were, what their, you know, what their beliefs and rituals were, and sort of like Yeats did traveling around Ireland and recording the fairy tales from the quote-unquote peasantry. So this guy was doing that, and he got, you know, he was also a philosopher. So this is a very, very large volume of work. It's probably, I mean, I read it on the Gutenberg Library website because it's not available to my knowledge in print. So, I mean, I'm sure there's some volumes out there that were printed, but it's a very, 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 I'd say it's probably 800 pages. And it's thick with, you know, mid-19th century language. So it's not exactly like, oh, a really relaxing But there's a lot of amazing information in there. And he goes from retelling stories to actually getting into kind of the philosophy behind werewolves. And so he has this whole section that's about, you know, how we can... I forget what the title of the chapter is, but it's something like, you know, we all have the propensity to become werewolves. And this is the part that like kind of really blew my mind when I was thinking about werewolves, because he's talking about, so it always debated, here's the werewolf, right? And the werewolf always seems somewhat out of control. The vampire is cursed, but the werewolf has this sort of thing that they know is going to happen to them. They transform, and most often they can't control their behavior. And then, you know, in one instance, I put a story in my book about this very sweet romantic werewolf who loved this woman and would remove himself from the village at the full moon so that he wouldn't transform and destroy her and kill her family. So he knew he had this thing that was coming and he would just sort of remove himself.
Yeah.
So Sabine Baring Gould gets into this idea that we all, if you have ever been so mad that you've seen red, if you've ever been so angry or outraged over something that you feel so, you can't even see straight, you're just furious, you actually have this ability, kind of like you're transforming in that moment. And maybe this is why it wasn't published, but he also talks about like pregnant women and hormones. Okay. And how they can have that same, yeah, it's like slippery slope there, buddy. But he talks about that sort of transformation that you have this fury, and serial killers have this fury and they don't have control over it. And he actually sort of equates this transformation and that shift, that shape shift, if you will, of a normal person or a somewhat regular human being into a ferocious beast, or to exhibit ferocious beast-like behavior. And he says, we all have the capacity for that.
Mm.
And that actually totally freaked me out. I thought, oh my, yes, I have had those moments. I have not picked up a knife or felt like killing someone, but I have had moments of so blind rage and anger where I literally only see red. The whole room turns red. I mean, it hasn't happened much in my life, but it has happened. It takes a lot. You know, generally I'm pretty easygoing. But I mean, I think, you know, we probably all have something that would trigger that sort of response in us, whether it's our a loved one being threatened or, you know, somebody doing something so outrageous.
Yeah.
And so that changed my view of werewolves and whether how real they were.
Well, I mean, is it on a quite a telling point there? Because obviously, going back into history, we have the Vikings who were known to have these berserkers.
Right.
And these fellas, I mean, you're pretty sure you're aware, but these guys would go into battle almost in a trance. But before they'd go into battle, a lot of times they would go into battle without any armor on. But they'd go in there with an animal skin on, normally a wolf.
So we're talking skinwalkers.
Again, right. That, you know, in the native culture, we get a similar sort of tale, don't we?
But, yeah, that's right.
But yeah, the Norse used to, what they used to do, they used to put this thing on, they used to go in there in a rage, and that's where we get the word berserk now.
Right.
They were called berserkers. There's some evidence
that they took, like some people say, oh, they must have taken this substance or, you know, they took something to like really get, but they would get themselves. Then there's other people who say, no, there really isn't any evidence to suggest that they were taking some kind of like psychotrope or something like that, but that, you know, sort of like primitive PCP. But they were, what they were doing is they were tapping into that rage and that energy, and they would terrify their, you know, anyone they were going into battle with, because yeah, they had these crazy, you know, furs on, and they were painted, they were just huge and insane and just like going all out. And you know, I mean, that's that idea of kind of going berserk. So they would kind of tap into that rage and that energy.
Yeah, that going back to sort of an animalistic nature, you know?
Most likely they were doing a kind of a, beforehand they might have done a ritual. Again, it's all, you know, ritual, something like, you know, a bear's got strength, or a wolf has got, you know, some prowess and, you know, speed to kill. And so again, it's kind of a ritual, isn't it? So,
just like I say, it's just interesting how it seems to, we get the same story all around the world, you know, this kind of, you know, he talks about skinwalkers, it's just, you know, it's a similar thing, and then you've got the Luguru, so.
But I think,
go ahead.
Yeah, so we're getting these reports all over the world now, you know, as you've been saying, on the werewolves, but these people actually transform. You know, it's actually they've got the rage. The actual what they are. You know,
that's the difference between a werewolf and like a dog.
So what we've got to see is talking about, are these real people turned into a creature? You know, these are normal, or are they?
Or are they cryptids? Mythological?
Yeah.
Are they supernatural? Have they gone over that line? I mean, I don't know that we'll ever know. I mean, the werewolf traditionally is a human that is transformed. But I do think, you know, one thing we're talking about, how, you know, we see this all over the world, and we see pagan cultures all over the world putting on animal skins and doing rituals that, you know, I'm sure the Romans thought were quite strange. And so part of what we have in the historical record is a very convoluted, fear-based description of something that was used to better a community. So I think that's very interesting as well, because, you know, you have someone's peering around the rock going, oh my God, they're putting on these things, and there's, you know, there's a werewolf and he's chasing him around, and it's dark, and you're in this unknown, you know, you've never been there before, and you're set to task to convert everyone or whatever is happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're kind of, your account is based in a fear and a lack of understanding. And so in that way, we still have that today with werewolves, dogmen, other cryptids, is that, you know, we like to kind of seek out fear. We're kind of looking for that thrill. And so many of our accounts are coming from a place of fear, or a place of, you know, maybe sensationalism, rather than an experience that it's different. Like if you were to have, say, a ghost in your room, you know, you think you might be afraid, but so often you have those experiences and they're almost normal when they're happening in that moment. And you don't really have the fear until it kind of passes and you realize what just happened. And I think that with, you know, these accounts of something loping alongside the road or the Beast of Bray Road, I mean, that's a road right in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And that's not that far from me. I have not been on that road, but you do have, you know, you have, not only do you have the story of it, but then you have the legend of it. And so now you're sort of driving really slowly and maybe that, you know, lumpy log suddenly looks a lot more like a werewolf. So you know, just slightly off topic, but on topic, I started a podcast of my own and I recently just called Tales of the Strange, and I'm going state by state in the United States right now. And I just interviewed Seth Breedlove. If you know his work, he does a series of, documentaries called Small Town Monsters. And I was interviewing him about the Boggy Creek Monster down in Arkansas. But he said that he has two more movies coming out, and one of them is about Bray Road. So that's exciting to look forward to.
I just find it fascinating with these. I mean, you know, I think it was last year when he told me about this dogman, and I didn't know what a dogman was until I started my research and listening to other people. I think I've come to my conclusion now is that some of these, because I think there's more than one species. It's not just one. I think there's more. But I think quite a lot of these are, they're very intelligent and very, very psychic. And I think they go from realm to realm. I think they can go from frequency to frequency. Some of them, not all of them. So, because, you know, some accounts was where they're here and also they just disappear. So, you know, I think there's some that can actually go through the frequencies or the realms. Mm. So where do these creatures come from? You know, again, with the fairies, the gnomes, the elves, I mean, they're on a different frequency or a different level. So it's quite obviously where do these creatures come from, and, you know, it's very strange.
So,
and also, like, if you're not everyone sees them, you have to be, not only do you have to be in the right place at the right time, but you have to be the right person. Not everyone, you can believe in these things your whole life and never see them. You know, and you can write about them and you can seek them out and you may never have that experience. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's that second sight. It's that psychic ability that many of us have and don't realize or recognize. And many people in the paranormal community maybe haven't even quite tapped into their full potential, but they're drawn to it for one reason or another. Mm. You know, we're drawn to the ghost stories because there's something in us that, you know, maybe you're suppressing that you saw a ghost when you were three, or any number of things like that. So they definitely, that whole supernatural realm, it's, I like to say, especially with fairies, that you, I think I might have even said this last time, but you, witches can see them with effort. Children can see them all the time, and they can be seen on accident by drunks. So that's kind of
depends what they're drinking.
Same with UFOs and how all much. Sorts of
I think possible that they now see when they turn up, they could be quite surprised that we see them. Mm. You know, was that account for in it? I think it was America a couple of years ago. I was listening to, and this guy was working inside his computer early hours of the morning, and he knew there was something wrong. He just got terrified, really frightened. A dogman was at the window, just watching him. Mm. You know, so he picked up that dogma was outside the window. So, you know, it's again, it's this sense. So we got. So
go on. Right. Then. Let's have your favorite werewolf story then.
My favorite werewolf story. Okay, so I had mentioned earlier there's a short story, I included it in my book, and it's by a man named Eugene Field, and it's a really, really sweet werewolf story. And I kind of liked it because Eugene Field was known for writing children's books, sweet children's books with beautiful sort of Maxfield Parrish-like illustrations. And then he has this werewolf story. And, you know, it's just not as well known. So I like that. And that story is just that it is your absolute classic, you know, gave birth to the sort of Lon Chaney idea of a werewolf, where this werewolf is otherwise a, you know, handsome, you know, upstanding citizen who has this disease, and he sort of has to kind of hide it away at certain times in order to make sure that he does not destroy the woman and that he loves and the village that he loves. But one of my favorite kind of short, more like historical stories is about this woman who is accused of, she's accused of being a werewolf. I'm going to just see if I can find it in the book here because it's pretty brutal. otherwise, I'll just recap it. So it's basically this woman. Yeah, it's Halloween, so it's perfect. Let's see. Yep. Okay, well, I'll just recap it because I don't see it here, but it's basically a 16th century werewolf story. And what happens is this woman, much, you know, in the 16th century and the 17th century, we had lots of people being accused of being witches. And if you weren't accused of being a witch, you might be accused of being a vampire or even a werewolf. And in this instance, we had a woman who probably was subjected to spousal abuse over a number of years. And as the story goes, she was found in the morning and her husband had been dismembered. So he had, you know, limbs sort of strewn about and he had been stabbed a number of times. Mm. So he wasn't just killed. He was like, you know, triple killed in a
just
rage.
Just to make sure. Yeah.
And she was a fairly slight woman and not particularly known for having a bad temperament. And when they found her, she was sort of just sitting there in a daze with his blood all over her hands. And they said, "What happened?" And she said, "I don't really know." And they found on her, according to the legend, according to the, you know, Witch Master General or whoever it was, who was the constable at the time, they found on her a little pouch. And in this pouch, there were three claws and a tuft of hair or something like that. So it was a little sort of charm that proved, of course, that's evidence that she was a werewolf and was transformed into a werewolf, killed him in a bloody rage. And that also explained why she didn't remember it the next day. And of course, she was tried and hanged.
Yeah.
Say, I shouldn't laugh, but you know.
I don't think there was any parole in them days, was there?
I'll tell you what, if people had a look in my missus's handbag, they'd think she was a werewolf as well. based on that, you know, what I mean? A couple of feathers and fucking
what? Yeah.
Right? Yeah, you look at my purse and you'd probably hang me based on what's stuck in the bottom of my bag. Yeah.
There's
a lot of stories like that. I didn't include them all in my book, but I found several kind of old tales like that about, you know, just complete mayhem and, you know, accusations of and sometimes you'd be a witch and a werewolf, or a witch would be blamed for transforming you into a werewolf. So that was always, and then there are some theories about what actually caused some of those werewolf like symptoms, you know, poisoning. And we know now that ergot poisoning was responsible for, you know, the witch craze, in the 1600s, where people basically ingested this mold that was on the bread, and it caused people to have hallucinations, and they were saying, oh, women are flying on brooms and they're slaughtering cattle, and, you know, all these kinds of things were happening, and it kind of fed into that fury. And at the same time, we had that happening with people, you know, accusing others of being werewolves or vampires and things. So that was, and then, you know, we also have in parts of Scandinavia, they have something that they call lycanthropic streams, which I always thought was the coolest thing ever. And there's a guy named Elliot O'Donnell, who was an Irish writer and part of a paranormal society in the early 1900s, and a really interesting guy. And he wrote a lot of amazing stuff about, he was one of the few people who wrote during that time who wasn't a skeptic. I mean, even William Butler Yeats was a skeptic when it came to some of these like fairy things. But he had had many paranormal experiences when he was a child. So he came at it from a very different point of view and was kind of a professional ghost hunter before it was, you know, trendy to be a ghost hunter.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did some work on werewolves as well. And he talked about these streams in Scandinavia that would turn you into a werewolf. And then there were plants that were antidotes to that. And today you think about that and you know you're not supposed to drink the stream because water from the stream because it can give you some kind of poisoning. And now that brings to mind, however, the question, if you are ingesting something that is altering your state, does that make that experience less valid, or are you actually seeing something you wouldn't be able to see otherwise? Is something being revealed to you in that state? And that is a, you know, that's a whole other topic for whether or not you will take evidence from someone who perhaps has gone into a trance or been mm-hmm. into an altered state and what they see.
Yeah.
It's different. I mean, yeah.
Would it be possible, though, to transform, say, that you had a basic frame, a physical human frame, to turn into a 7-8 foot, you know,
but what if you just
kind
believe,
of creature?
Just,
I mean, you believe, tear you apart, won't it?
What if you believe
physically?
You've changed, though?
Well, that's a
so that's a whole other thing, too, You do have people who, there's still a medical diagnosis today called lycanthropy, where people believe that they have transformed into a werewolf and they'll be institutionalized for it. And, you know, then you have people with hormonal imbalances that cause an excessive amount of hair. And so they were accused of being werewolves. And, you know, I mean, I can't really answer. Could that be? I mean, I hope that's possible. I mean, that's what makes it all exciting,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
That it's actually possible that and werewolves kind of, unlike many of the other cryptids that you read about, you know, werewolves in particular are the ones that are the most likely to have started as humans or have been sort of a human who, you know, moves on. I mean, you have vampires and they say that there's a certain curse or you get the bite of the vampire and you share this blood disease and it, you know, you become a vampire yourself. But with werewolves, there's almost a sort of like, oops, I stumbled on the wrong thing. And now I was this, you know, pretty regular guy. But in parts of right now I live in the United States in sort of the upper Midwest, and there are a number of stories from this area from the indigenous people who lived here about kind of the original werewolf legends, and that the werewolves actually came from, there was a group who was starving, and they were basically, they went out and they met the Great Spirit, and the Spirit said, okay, I'm going to give you two the ability to become werewolves. And with this ability, you will be able to hunt and you will be able to, you know, save everyone from starvation.
Yep.
But the one thing you cannot do is turn upon another human being. You cannot just use this shape-shifting power, this magic power that I'm giving you. You can't just use this willy-nilly. You can only use it to hunt. Okay, fine. So time goes on. There are these wonderful hunters. Everybody loves them. You know, they're feeding their tribe. Everything's going fairly well. And then one day, you know, one of the two, of course, they're young men. So one of the two gets very jealous of something and he gets into a fight with one of the other young men in the group. And he transforms into a werewolf at the wrong time and uses it to sort of strike this guy down. Well, almost immediately, they are banned from the group, both of them, even though it was really only one of them. You know, you always get punished for the one bad apple.
Yeah.
And they were sent and they were sent into the woods to live and basically live a life of solitude. And so only occasionally when they would, you know, be missing their loved ones, you would hear them sort of howl and they sounded just like the wolves. And eventually you couldn't tell them apart from the pack of wolves, except for their eyes. So that was that's actually one of the original werewolf stories of how werewolves came in the United States. It's kind of sad and sweet at the same time. But there is a magical, supernatural element to that, again, we have a tendency to dismiss that as valid, but, you know, I mean, that's the origin of it all, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've always said, you know, everything's magic anyway. Everything, you know, you live and breathe. That's magic. No.
Right. Just the very way your body functions is magic.
Witches now then. Witches Valor.
Is it something you've come across writing-wise?
Any stories of witches, or obviously there's different...
Oh, yes. You know. Oh, I love witches. I was raised by a witch, so I have a particular fondness for witches. Now, I don't identify as a Wiccan or as a formal witch in any kind of religious sense, but my mother was always a... she's an occultist. She taught me to read tarot cards and do lucid dreaming without even meaning to. She knows a lot about herbs, and she just sort of lives a witchy lifestyle without necessarily identifying in a formal fashion. So, now witches are interesting because there's not really a werewolf religion, right? I mean, maybe there is, and I don't know about it. There are some vampire religions.
There probably is, yeah.
Yeah.
Quite a Twilight fan club or some shit.
Right, yeah. Right.
You get a doggy bag and a free badge, don't you? That's what it is.
You just put this wig on, you'll fit right in.
Yeah.
And there are some vampire religions. There are people who practice psychic vampirism or who practice as living vampires, and they admittedly... in part of their sort of magical approach to the philosophy and the religion, it is a glamorous approach. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually speaking with someone tomorrow night about his kind of, vampire 101. And he's one of the heads of like this big clan of vampires. And they put on these balls and they get dressed up it's sort of generally open to the public, but it's really at its core, there are these people who operate on the understanding that they identify more with the vampire and the vampire culture and the sort of, there's a whole iconography that goes along with it, living in the twilight versus the daylight. And they refer to, sort of like the way we might say like a muggle, it's like our human muggle sort of relatives, and those are your daylight relatives, and then you have your twilight clan, and those are the people, those are your people, right? So there is that sort of thing. Now, but what with witches, it really sets them apart because witchcraft has such a cult following and so many different facets of it. You have people like, people like Sybil Leek and Ray Buckland, who both came from England and then came over to the United States and introduced an old way of witchcraft to a bunch of hippies who are like, oh yeah, we can totally identify with this. This makes sense. This is living with the earth and this is part of, what we understand. And so unlike many other sort of, supernatural creatures, witches are the most real and actually have their own sort of many different kind of they have a religious path, unlike many other of these, how like the Bigfoot clan or the werewolf clan, as we were saying. So not that they're all the same. I'm not lumping, not all witches are Wiccan, and I'm not lumping them all together by any means. But unlike many other sort of, these sort of supernatural kind of dark entities, the witches have this, their own reverence, and magic has its own reverence. And thankfully, it does go in cycles, but there's something that, that sort of Harry Potter phenomenon that helped younger generations understand at a very young age how important magic and witchcraft is. And so instead of being afraid of it, it's revered. And I've heard a few grumblings in the, deep Wiccan community, but I personally, the more witchcraft that's out there, the better. Witches really get a bad rap. They're always called, they're Satanists, or they're doing,
that's a Hollywood
this or
call,
that.
Isn't it? The movies.
Quite the opposite. I mean, if you've ever met a real witch, I mean, they're just all about healing. They're all about, alternative medicine and taking care of their community. And yeah, they might, they might fuck with you a little bit. It's kind of, you don't... If you know how to do it, it's hard to resist, the occasional little light hex or something like that. But I think, I have a lot of, everything from just classic stories about witches. I mean, I have like quite a collection of sort of witch stories. And in every fairy tale, there's a witch somewhere in there. That's the one who trapped you in the tree or turned you into a toad. So the witch just has this wonderful kind of, over the top power, the very omnipresent kind of transform any plot line into, in any situation, it can be changed. And they're probably the most domesticated form of magic that we have.
Yeah. Again, it's very interesting. So you got the witches, but nothing much said about, I know there's a few programs about, but warlocks, you know, male witches. So it's always the women, isn't it? The females, but not the,
and actually many men that I know that practice witchcraft just identify as witches.
Yeah, not warlocks.
And they don't like to be, but you know, we like to say warlocks because we're so gender specific and we don't, don't want anyone thinking we're running around in a skirt or something, you know, God forbid that a man should wear a skirt. So
priest
certain does. Terms.
A priest does it. Yep. He wears a skirt. He wears a frock.
Yeah. He wears a dress. It.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, if you've seen some of those, you know, those images of some of the early, especially the Roman Catholic kind of outfits, I mean, those look more like pointy hat witch hats than anything. You know, so you kind of see this crossover there.
Yeah, it was the mitre, because if you look at the hat itself, it looks like it's a fish head, like a fish head. That comes actually from Babylon times. The Vatican, still today, they don't worship Jesus or anything like that, never have done. They worship a fish god called Dagon, and this is why they've got the fish head, you know, so it's actually a being called Dagon. They still do it today. Mind you, the Vatican is, again, not a very nice place. But, that's my view, I'm afraid. That's my belief.
if you're a little boy.
Or a woman with any power,
That's what the priest is doing, really, isn't it? Because he's wearing a frock, he's actually taking the power from a woman.
Yeah. That's too scary for Halloween, I think.
That's not the kind of scare we want. Yeah. But certainly, it's very interesting because you also have the idea that, you know, this portrayal of the witch as this kind of hideous hag that...
Yep.
You know, ambles along the road and is just kind of there to scare you. And the truth is that we want to look at beautiful things. We don't want to look at our own mortality. And so when people look at an old woman, they instantly think, hag, old woman, bad, I'm going to die one day. And so we portray these beings as something sort of, you know, hideous instead of just being a natural part of life, and you know, just as anything will age and wrinkle and eventually die, seeing old people or seeing someone who is a little bit different, maybe your eye is wonky or, you know, anything that doesn't fit that conventional idea of beauty. And that has been the case much longer than just, you know, Hollywood. That has been the case. I mean, that is kind of at the core of the witch craze and the witch trials, is that these sort of single, women with land who didn't fit the norms of society, and probably, and many of them were witches. People came to them for, you know, knowledge about what do I take because I don't want to have this baby, or what can I do to make him, you know, look at me when I walk through the market, or whatever kind of little charms and things. I mean, these were the women who were the herbalists, and men, there were men as well that understood this. And, you know, so then that person becomes immediately the scapegoat and the most vulnerable member of society. Also, they probably have like a big chunk of land or something else that someone wants.
Yeah.
Otherwise, right, they're left untouched, right?
Yeah.
Certainly an easy way to get what you wanted. Why don't you just say, oh, she did this, she cast a spell on me and off.
Well, this is, I think this is what we're, and it's still, religion still does it today, is to actually dumb people down and keep, I mean, then people in them days could have been psychic mediums. you know, right. And beautiful people, and work with the Mother Earth nature and with their energies and that. But to the religion, they were a threat. You know, it couldn't right. be seen as that. So.
Right, it's no accident that so many conventional religious holidays fall ever so close to traditional pagan holidays.
Yep.
If you can't beat them, join them. Yep. Okay, so instead of, okay, you want to have this little celebration, and many people would, you know, for example, the solstice, they would go to church because they didn't want to be harassed, and so they would go to church on the, you know, evening of the 24th of December. And they would light their candles, but inside they were like, yeah, this is the solstice. We're like lighting the candle that we would have lit anyway. So you're kind of having your rituals at the same time. And you certainly have this a lot in the UK, where churches were built directly on top of
ley lines
and yeah. places that were of significant magical importance to yep. people who lived there before, you know, before the Roman Catholic and the, you know, the religious had, or transformation.
We actually met with Maria Wheatley, didn't we?
Oh, I you know what? I yeah, listened to that show. Oh. I loved her. She's amazing.
Yeah,
she's absolutely amazing.
Maria.
And she's so knowledgeable and has such a comprehensive understanding of both the archaeological and historical record and the mystical and magical under, you know, so many times you only get one of those points of view, and it's
it opened my eyes a bit, because when she was on about the Druids, when the Romans came, and they went straight to kill the Druids, didn't they? The first port of call was the Druids, take them out.
Right.
Yeah,
take them out.
Take them out.
They got power.
Yeah, that's it. Take them out.
Well, that's very similar to what goes on today.
Well, that's behind doors now.
Sure. Well, you do have that kind of similar epidemic with fear.
Yeah.
With just trying to create fear, which is, you know, we are supposed to be afraid of witches. We are supposed to be afraid of the people we don't understand. It's the only way to maintain power is to make sure that everybody is afraid enough that they need you to protect them.
Yep.
That's how you maintain that kind of status of power. So I could say a lot of things about that. I think, you know, I live in the United States.
Yeah.
So
yeah, same with us.
There's much to fear, but it's probably not the thing you think you're supposed to fear. You know, there's a sort of a reverse fear happening
Absolutely.
Over here right now. So.
Absolutely. So, moving on then, should we move on to
to one of my favourites?
This is my least favourite.
Oh, it's one of my favourites.
Your favourite?
Yes.
Vampires.
Oh, nice. Okay, yeah, we could go all night with vampires.
Does your best. The reason I don't like vampires is I know you're going to speak to some, and I should probably speak to. Probably speak to some, because you hear these horror stories of these nut jobs who go around to old granny's houses and cut out their hearts and all that because he thinks he's going to live forever and that. And that really just puts me off vampires completely.
Well, he's not a vampire, is he? He's just
he says he's under the cloak of being a vampire.
Well, that could be someone just to get off insanity,
but,
you know.
But that's what does me for vampires.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I'm
right.
I see, I see what you're saying.
But I'm willing to be educated,
right, but that's
so.
Also like saying, you know, oh, you listen to Marilyn Manson, so that's why, you know, you got a gun and shot up, you know, high school.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? It's not the individual. But I do, there are vampire stories like that, however. And, you know, if you just think of the most iconic vampire story of them all, which is Dracula. Dracula, you know, Bram Stoker drew upon some, you know, he sort of combined some pretty horrific myths, or not myths, but horrific famous people in the past, especially in the sort of Transylvanian area. And one of them was Madame Bathory. Now, I heard a very interesting podcast recently all about her. Now, she was this woman who had a great deal of power. She had her own castle, and she basically was, you know, she was not supposed to be in power, but everybody else died. And so everything was left to her. So she had this huge castle, and the legend is that she would torture, that she was very fond of torture. And so she would have young girls especially come to work on the, in the castle, and she would torture them, like, physically torture them, not just harass them, but cut them and tie them up and do very strange things to them. And eventually
she's still got people to turn up to the job.
Well, yeah, because, you know, she had all the money. I mean, it was sort of, you know, that kind of system where it was like, okay, well, we're going to starve or we're going to go and work in the castle. So then the legend continues that at a certain point, she was also very beautiful. And so this is also, you get that kind of Sleeping Beauty, Wicked Stepmother thing going on. She wanted to be viewed as the most beautiful. And as she aged, and keep in mind, aging then, she was probably 30. As she aged and her waistline began to thicken, she would have these young girls come and she would get sort of obsessed with them. Well, eventually she began to believe that if she bathed in their blood, she would actually become immortal.
Okay.
So she kind of was combined with Vlad the Impaler, who was this ferocious leader who would take the Romani armies out, and, you know, he would put the heads of his enemies on pikes and stick them out in front of his castle and, do all these kind of medieval torture. So those kind of legends became combined into this idea that Vlad Dracula was kind of this creepy guy who lived in a castle and, you know, needed blood to survive, along with, it's the vampire legend, of course. Recently, I heard something very interesting about Madame Bathory that made me, and I couldn't believe I had never thought of this before, but it was on a podcast called Lore, and he kind of got deeper into the legend and talked about how it really, what her status was, and that although there were these legends and the castle was supposed to be haunted and they supposedly found all these things, the only account we have for that are the relatives from the neighboring duchy who came over and took control of that land. It was them, it was their word against hers.
Yeah.
And so some of these, maybe she wasn't very nice to the young ladies, but some of these things may have been embellished. She was actually imprisoned in her own castle and eventually died there. So it was a little bit of that. I started thinking, I never thought of her as, you know, a victim in any way, but how do we know that this was really as bad as all that? But nonetheless, she sort of gave way to that, the idea that bathing in blood and consuming, that's not an original idea to that, but that enhanced sort of Bram Stoker's like approach to Dracula and the Dracula legend. Now, blood, of course, I mean, that's been part of, it's still part of ritual, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're drinking the blood of Christ when you're drinking that goblet of red wine. So we know that there's so much attached with that as, like, symbolically, as giving us kind of, you know, a sort of life force. So you have vampires that, you know, feed on that in order to recreate a life force. So when you hear about some complete nutter that goes and, like, stabs a heart out or whatever, their idea that they're a vampire, yes, they're very misguided, but unfortunately there are legends that, you know, give credence to the idea that that's why at least somebody was accused of being a vampire for doing something like that, much like the woman who dismembered her husband and was accused of being a werewolf.
Well, I feel sorry for that guy, because if he's real in what he says, right, and he's going to live forever for eating that old granny's heart, he's in a jail cell forever, basically.
Mm. I know,
so,
right?
So how's that going to work for
cursed
you?
Cursed either way.
Yeah.
But there are people that I know that identify as vampires in a very different way, and they identify more in the, I mean, we've all heard the term psychic vampire. We've all experienced psychic vampires. There's people who literally drain you of all of your energy. And a good practicing vampire, a good practicing psychic vampire would call somebody like that an irresponsible, unawakened vampire. And that basically, you know, from an outsider, it's like you're a really needy, really highly sensitive psychic person, and you are relying on somebody else to feed you their own energy and their own life force. And so you enter into a relationship, and it's much like a BDSM relationship where two people are consenting, and they are, one's the feeder and one's the giver, basically. So you do have, you know, that kind of modern view of vampires, where then in order to do that, you can go forth into the world and be the person you're meant to be, and perhaps you use your psychic abilities for good, or, you know, you are able to just function in your daily job because you're a sensitive, you're an intuitive, and you never quite are able to wrangle all of those feelings without this aid from, you know, your, I forget what they call it, but it's like your donor, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes a lot of
but
sense.
That's not the kind of vampire you want to talk about, is it? You want to talk about the good old-fashioned, super wicked, totally awesome vampire.
Yes,
do you want to talk about the Bela Lugosi kind of? Well, I think probably one of my favorite vampire stories that is so there's two vampire stories when I was writing the book that I kind of stumbled upon. One is the first vampire novel ever written in English. And that was written and conceived of at the same night that Mary Shelley came up with Frankenstein. So they were, you know, there was Lord Byron had a doctor who was there that night, his traveling physician who would travel with him, and his name was John William Polidori. And that night when they were sort of, well, it was kind of over a week where it's like, let's see if we can scare each other with a ghost story. Mary Shelley, it's legendary. She had a dream about this mad doctor, and she had kind of started forming this character. And so she sort of wrote out the bones of Frankenstein. And they all kind of wrote different short stories. Let's see, Lord Byron was there. Percy Bysshe Shelley, Mary Shelley, I think there was another woman there, and Polidori was there. And this was in Lake Geneva and in Switzerland on this dark and stormy night, right? The lights all go out and they're writing these ghost stories. And they were reading from a book of ghost stories. They were trying to scare each other, and they were all writers. So Polidori, who fancied himself a writer but was really a doctor by training, actually took kind of the rough draft that Byron had come up with that night, and he asked his permission if he could run with it, basically. Can I run with this idea? And it was about a kind of this vampire legend. So the story itself is not particularly compelling, but what's compelling is the introduction, which I read not knowing anything about it, and then kept, this really sounds familiar. Why does this sound familiar? Is he talking about Frankenstein? And then I realized, because he doesn't name anyone in his introduction, he just says, M, you know, or blah, blah. So eventually I figured it out, and then I bothered to do a little research and realized that it was, in fact, the same kind of dark and stormy night that Frankenstein was created as well. So that's kind of a cool, and that one's just called The Vampire. It's spelled VAMPYRE. I don't have the whole story in my book because it's really long. And it was met with a lot of criticism. Many people thought it was Lord Byron who had written it and actually lied about it because it wasn't that good. But Byron insisted that it was Polidori and gave Polidori full credit and full, you know, carte blanche to do what he wanted with it. Yeah, and
because it wasn't that good.
Probably,
it's not,
yeah.
It's not my work, you know.
Yeah, so you never actually know. Yeah, you never actually know who. Yeah, just sure, you can have that. That was crap, you know. So his scraps. But in any case, it became, you know, a pretty significant story in that it was the first vampire novel published in English, and it was published long before Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. And I'm sure he read this. I'm sure that this was part of the. You know, there are some kind of classic vampire elements to it that many writers from there on out built upon. But the best vampire story I've ever read was actually one of the first vampire stories, and it was published in, it's French, and it was published in English in probably, I don't even remember now, but it was late 18th. It was probably early 1800s that it was finally published in the English language and translated properly. Now, it may have been translated prior to that, but it was censored this was the translation. You know, I mean, the French, I think we all know the French have their own sensibility, especially French literature. Yep. It's the morality in French literature traditionally can be quite different and quite looser than some people were comfortable with in Victorian England, certainly, mm-hmm. and in early Quaker United States, certainly. But nonetheless, it's this beautiful story, and it's called Claremonde, or La Morte Amoureuse, and it is basically the story of a man who, just when he is about to take the final vows to enter into priesthood, this woman blows into the church, and she is just long, dark hair and sort of supernatural, ethereal-looking features. And she causes him to question, in that one look, she causes him to question everything that he has, the entire trajectory of his life. And I don't want to give away the ending or tell you too much about the story, because it's really, really an excellent story. But they go down some dark roads, and there's a wee bit of necrophilia in there for you, just in time for Halloween. So it's got it all, really.
You gotta try it once, haven't you?
Well, yeah.
Twice if you like.
If you can manage it, yeah, I suppose so.
But all right, should we finish on a banshee story then?
Or banshees.
It's going back to the fairies again, so.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because so much of what I ended up putting in the fairy book, I found when I was writing and researching about banshees, and I just sort of like bookmarked things, like come back to the pukas and the changelings, because I was trying to focus on the banshee, and so many people don't actually know what a banshee is. But of course, what's so amazing about banshees is they straddle that world between fairy and sort of ghost, right?
Mm, so yeah. They're almost like the Grim Reaper sort of archetype,
right.
Mm. Yeah.
Right, and they are sort of the harbinger or the portent of death or a grave illness. Mm. But they in themselves don't necessarily cause great harm directly to you, unlike maybe like a poltergeist or something like that. They just sort of, when you see them, you basically know, bad news is coming, right? Bad news is on the rise. So, so the banshee, one of my favorite...
see them or hear them.
So you can see them or hear them. Some people are able for both, can see and hear them, and other people can only will only hear. Like, and for some, it will sound like a scream. For others, it will sound like a wail, like a crying sound. Mm. In fact, many people are sort of lured out to check on what sounds like a woman crying. Mm. And you may have encounters where you'll see sort of an innocent-looking little old lady hobbling down the road who then transforms into the banshee and screams in your face. And then you're like, oh, no, Tommy's going to die. So
what did they say? That these people that have seen it, what did they say it looks like? Out of the old woman form.
The most common view is that it is a woman with dark hair and relatively beautiful features, but with something quite off, like glowing eyes and sharp, horrific teeth.
Mm. Sounds like a night out in Cleethorpes.
One too many.
Yeah.
One not enough.
And then the other account is like an old lady that then, something harmless that then looks, you know, hideous. And then the third most common account is something that looks hideous from the get-go, just like something screaming and horrific that you would run from, usually sort of disembodied or floating, that you don't usually see feet and hands and things like that. And the banshee will arrive to, originally the banshees belonged to like a family or a place. And so there's a lot of exploration about counterparts to the banshee. Technically, the banshee itself is Irish, and that, you know, an actual banshee, which means like of the fairy mound, it belongs in Ireland, and that they're everywhere else that you have banshee-like creatures, they are different names or different entities. That's, you know, that's up for debate, but you could say that about many different creatures. And I think, you know, with fairies and things of the fairy realm, you will have a different name for it just in the next village over. and people will call something a goblin that you might refer to as an elf, and you can see that the characteristics are very similar, or perhaps what is an elf in Scandinavia is more like a gnome in Italy. So, you know, we have just these kind of general terms that we throw around for things, but the banshee traditionally is Irish and is inherited by people in certain clans or at certain places, for example, you know, a castle or something like that.
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't mean that everyone in that family can see the banshee. And I think it's just a gift of the sight, whether or not you're able to see the banshee, not everyone can see it. Then you have warnings from around the world that would be thought of much like a banshee, a ghost that appears to warn you of the death or of someone you know coming to harm, or you find out there's a car accident that night. And it's not necessarily the ghost of that person. I'm not talking about when someone dies and then you see them sitting on the foot of your bed and, you know, you wake up the next day and find out that they've died. We're talking about a specific kind of, you know, the woman in white or a banshee-like creature that appears and warns you of this death. And it's really one of the more terrifying creatures because it's someone that you love. Like, there's nothing you can do, but someone that you love is going to die or become extremely ill, and it's not you. It's rarely you. And that's probably the worst feeling in the world, isn't it? That's not even going to be you. It's going to be, you know, someone else.
You could sort of, yeah, I mean, you can imagine, can't you? You hear this wail and then you think, oh shit, you know, someone's going to die. But yeah, it's not you. That must
yeah,
be
you're
the,
like, what, but yeah. who? Yeah.
I wonder if some of these can be, you know, accidental deaths, I guess, but a lot of these deaths will be reported to be like illness, that kind of thing. So I wonder if it's more psychological than anything. I wonder if it's one of these where we kind of know in the back of our mind.
Mm.
And we need something to sort of show us it's going to happen. It's an exit. Well, and also a lot of the accounts of banshees were certainly, they were more prevalent during a time when something like a fever would actually wipe out a whole family.
Yeah.
Before we had vaccinations and modern medicine to sort of prevent things like scarlet fever or things that would actually could, you know, rage through a household or a valley and you know, kill most people in their path. Mm. I mean, you know, you had women dying in childbirth on a regular basis. And so you would see some association with women dying in childbirth and banshees. And also some ideas that the banshee is actually a sort of the impression left after a woman has died in childbirth or has, you know, killed a child or lost a child at a young age, and that is that wailing and that mourning. And so they're basically appearing to say, you will soon feel the way I feel. This terror that you're feeling right now is going to be a regular thing because you're going to lose someone that you love the way I did. So there's a lot of association with that kind of just particularly sad form of death. Mm.
What's the normal time frame between hearing the wail and someone passing away?
Usually within like a day.
Yeah,
24 a day hours, 40 or so. Hours, 2 days.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. Yeah. So, right, get your affairs in order. Send your, you know, well wishes. Mm. Tell them you love them.
Life insurance.
Yeah, life insurance. Yeah.
Make sure your policy is up to date.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's as good as a place as any to end it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on again.
Thank you, Viola. It's been fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, great. Thank you. I hope we are able to scare people just a little bit in time for Halloween. Yeah.
No, definitely.
Do you just want to tell people where they can find you again and mention that podcast again?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. It's varlaventura.net. So that's varlaventura.net. And there you will find links to all of my books. My books are available anywhere books are sold. You can get them online. They're widely in print. I think they're distributed throughout the UK, Canada, US, and Australia. So you should be able to get them at a regular little brick and mortar store if you order them. And the podcast is called Tales of the Strange. And right now we are working on season one, Strange America. The first episode is up on my website and should be available. I think it's available for download everywhere but iTunes, because they have their little process. You probably know about that. It takes a little bit to get green lighted there, but that should be within the next week or so. And then the next episode will be up shortly. And we're just going alphabetically through the United States of Strange over here.
Sounds cool to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you guys both for having me. It's been delightful. I would...